Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Lori Townsend of APRN, Richard Maurer of the Anchorage Daily News, and Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch. The Shell oil drilling rig Kulik makes headlines all over the United States and gets the attention of Congress, the Interior Department, environmentalists, and the oil industry itself. Richard, you covered this incident from Anchorage. What's the summary of what happened, and how does management of this crisis, how did management of this crisis unfold here in Anchorage?
The ship left. There was a tow vessel called the Ivic, and it was specially built to haul this drilling rig, which is a big, heavy. It's a very heavy rig, and not giant in the scale of rigs you see in the Gulf of Mexico, but a lot of iron. And so it was towing this thing. It left Dutch Harbor on the 21st. A week later, it had not quite gotten to Kodiak to tell you how slow it was going, and it got caught in a giant storm. The wind was pulling it back, and the cable snapped between the Ivic and the Kulik, the drill rig. There was a second cable, so they thought they were okay. And then all four engines on the Ivic, very, very powerful engines, they just died. And so at that point, they lost it. Some other tugs came to help, other boats. They put on lines, the lines broke. Finally, the last tug came from Prince William Sound, the Alert, part of the rescue operation. It had a good line to the drill rig, but the wind was so strong by that time they had tried to get to a port. They couldn't get to a port by this time. The wind is so strong it's pulling the Alert back towards the rocks, and they said, "We got to cut." And so they cut. The Kulik winds up on the rocks. Big incident. How did this happen? The big command forms here in Anchorage. They take over a ballroom at the Marriott Hotel, and they attempt to resolve this through a lot of different agencies.
If you went to that ballroom, you mm-hmm. walked into the room. What did you see?
Well, I don't know because they didn't let anyone in. As far as I know, I don't know if anyone else
got called.
In.
You only called in.
We went to press conferences. They held a press conference in a different room, but it was very controlled. And at first, it was, "We'll tell you what we think you need to know," and that broke off a little bit, but it ended up being really where Shell was the chief spokesman for this thing. The Coast Guard was also involved, and they only told you what they wanted to tell you, nothing about anything other than what is currently happening. I think the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation had a representative there. He was far more open, but...
Do we know who the members were or agencies were who were on the command?
Sure, it was the Coast Guard. Shell was in charge, Coast Guard, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. At first it was Edison Schwest, the company that owned the Ivic. They mysteriously disappeared with no real, we were asked, how come they're not on this anymore? Well, they're not needed for the recovery, okay. And were replaced by the company that manages the drilling operation, Noble. And then at some point, the Kodiak Barrow also got put on the Unified Command. But Shell was in charge.
Let's go to Jill. Jill, you went to Kodiak to cover the grounding. What did you see?
Frankly, not too much different than probably what folks were experiencing in Anchorage in terms of the command structure, and the command center was in the Best Western on Kodiak that overlooks the harbor. They weren't letting people into their room either. They weren't talking much either.
So this is a subset of the group that was in Anchorage?
It is
that?
Yes. The difference, I would say, in Kodiak, at least you were seeing a lot of staging take place. You were seeing equipment coming in that was going to get flown out to the site. You were seeing Army helicopters come in. You were seeing at one point the tugs come into port, and I'm assuming get fuel, equipment, do checks, whatever they needed to do. The two that are predominantly affiliated with the operation, the Nanook and the Ivic. And then we made it out to Old Harbor, which is a town site, village site that was close to the grounding site, although buffered by the island on which the tug...
30 miles or something?
No, by which the rig grounded. I think Old Harbor is actually only about 10 miles mm-hmm. away from that site. The rig itself, after it was you know, unbeached and refloated, ended up 30 miles away in a bay of shelter where they're inspecting it now. But same thing in Old Harbor, you know, people there, a lot of memories of the Exxon had people kind of rattled and a little bit concerned about what the possibilities of a larger scale disaster might be. Certainly this didn't have the potential to be anything close to an Exxon. It wasn't carrying crude, it just had diesel on board, although a lot of diesel. And people weren't feeling like they were getting a lot of information, average community members. But in Old Harbor, there was another kind of command structure set into place with the corporation, which owned the island, the village, and the city. We're kind of all working together, sitting in on a lot of teleconferences, obviously getting information from Kodiak.
And sometimes in those situations, members of the public will ask reporters questions because they think the reporters know something. Was that the case here?
Not too much. I mean, we were asking people what they thought and what they knew, and it's, in some cases we were getting asked questions back. But mainly people just wanted that thing gone. They wanted the threat of a problem away from their area. They wanted it off the beach, and they wanted to make sure everything was done environmentally gentle as possible.
Okay. Lori Townsend, how do you cover an event like this when you can't get specifically to the site? There's a no-fly zone, and the people who are in charge are, what should we say, carefully editing what they have to tell
Managing the information flow.
I was looking for a way to say this. Thank you. Go ahead.
Well, it's difficult. I think that's when having the advantage of having a network of stations, as we do, really helps. So we had someone at KMXT in Kodiak, but we were operating up against having short-staffed stations at holiday times. And so we had a reporter in Dutch Harbor who had been following what was going on with Shell for quite a long time, Stephanie Joyce at KUCB.
And presumably had seen the drilling rig.
Yes, and she was in Cancun and actually got in touch with me from Cancun and said, look, I'll send you scripts of the stories I've been working on and I'll help as much as I can from Cancun. So she was, you know, offering help from the beaches.
But I don't get too sunburned.
Yes, and Jay Barrett had his only other reporter that he has was out sick, so he was trying to manage everything that he had to do and cover all the news shifts. So we couldn't get somebody to Old Harbor, but Jay picked up the story and covered it for us from Kodiak. So we did the best we could with limited staffing during the holidays.
Okay, Richard, you were going to add something?
Yeah, I got to say, we're all suffering from limited staff, but there's not only a no-fly zone, there was a no-sail zone imposed by the Coast Guard, and there was a no-walk zone imposed by the Village Corporation, which owned the island.
Yeah.
So it was in essence, North Korea, and and we, you know, how do you get to the site? How do you do any kind of independent monitoring of the situation? And it was virtually impossible without breaking the law.
Yeah, it was very constricted. And I would add to that, like, it got to the point with us, with the Unified Command, where you could at least for a while call the National Weather Service and find out kind of what are the weather conditions there at the day, you know, for the day, and people would help you. And that's always been the case. We've always been able to contact a forecaster and get information. And at some point that shifted, and we were routed to Unified Command to get the appropriate weather forecast for the day or the weather conditions at the time, which seemed very strange to us.
It was outrageous. The Weather Service actually was blocked. Lisa Diemer was trying to reach, one of our reporters was trying to reach the Weather Service last night about what was the forecast for the weeks leading up to that, and they said, in Anchorage, they said, well, we can't talk about that. What? You're the Weather Service.
Right.
And it was so tightly controlled.
Could you explain this no-walk zone to us?
The Village Corporation owns Sitgalidic Island, most of it, and in order, if you can't sail because the Coast Guard has a cordon around it, and you can't fly because the FAA is blocking, you can't get a helicopter in the air, you know, we would probably share the cost of that with TV. Well, then maybe we can take a boat from Old Harbor and a fishing boat and pull in somewhere and walk over this hill, you know, fight off the bears or whatever's there, and be above the scene and take pictures from the mountain. No. The Old Harbor Village Corporation says, no, we're not going to let you trespass on our land. So where are you at?
And the shareholders are allowed access, but nobody wanted to go. I mean, we tried everything. We're like, you know, who will take a boat over? Who can get close? Who might be able to take pictures for us? And everybody was really concerned. You know, it's a small town, and somebody's going to know at the end of the day who got over there, who took a picture, who was in violation potentially of breaking the law or an access right.
Let's go back to Richard here. Richard, Interior Secretary Kenneth Salazar called Shell's mishap troubling. Mm-hmm. Is that code for something? If so, what? And what are Congress, lawmakers, and other organizations going to be doing in the next few months?
Well, I don't know if it's, I don't know if troubling is code, but it is certainly some concern. This is not Shell's first mishap since it began trying to drill up there. There was a containment dome that collapsed, other things that happened. And there's been a lot of pressure from the environmental community and from others on the Interior Department. Why are you letting Shell do this when, you know, first, there was pressure before Shell even began, and then when Shell had these problems, the pressure only increased. And so Ken Salazar appears to be responding to a real situation, which is, you know, what is Shell up to? How is Shell capable of managing this thing? And the pressure situation, which is politics. And I mean, who knows?
And Congress is going to hold hearings and mm-hmm. be some kind of institutional report, I suppose, from the Interior Department or other managers.
Correct. Well, and Coast Guard will talk about this specific accident or what, you know, what actually happened here.
And I think they have to do that, right?
Oh, yeah. And they're going to. And they often do very, I mean, I remember at the time of the Exxon Valdez, they did a very thorough look at this thing. And I think they're very competent investigators. And there are lots of questions about why did they leave at the time? Why were they so far from the coast? Why were they using one vessel to tow this rig? And this is a marine situation. This is a common transit point. This is not magic
in the winter.
Well, yeah, but this is not magic Arctic Ocean drilling.
Right.
This is something that's, you know, this is old technology.
Jill, what happens to the Kulik now?
Right now, it's anchored in the sheltered bay about 30 miles away from the site. It's undergoing inspections with remote operated vehicles, potentially divers if they need to do it, to kind of assess really what is the situation with this vessel. My expectation would be that if it's deemed to be seaworthy and it can get the appropriate clearances, that they will just fire up the caravan and head for Seattle again. I don't know that that's what they'll be able to do, but my what I'm hearing, I don't know what you're hearing, Rich or Lori, but that's really where they want to end up. They have a shipyard in Seattle that they've worked with in the past that they want to get back to so that these repairs can be made. And then the other thing about policy for drilling anyway is that in the event the Kulik is not up and ready to go, the drilling program will be in peril regardless of what the administration decides to do, because those two ships, the Discover and the Kulik, need to work in tandem. They're backup for each other in case there's a problem. And if one is out, my understanding is the operation doesn't go.
Lori, as we heard earlier, a number of villages and villagers have been caught right in the middle of this. What did you hear about their response and how they felt about what was going on around them?
Well, I think that Jill and Richard both characterized it well, in that, you know, it was difficult to find out what was going on because of the access issue. But it seemed to me that people were very concerned because of images of the Exxon Valdez still in their mind. But yet they went about helping to prepare right away. They got involved with getting boom loaded up and helping to be ready in case there was a spill. And so I think they were just sort of resigned to, we have to be prepared for this. We wish it would go away and not impact our area. There's also a site there that has a lot of historical significance to them. Lisa Diemer went to Old Harbor for the Daily News and wrote an excellent story on the people there and their concerns about this site where many Aleutic people were murdered by Russians in the 1700s. Mm-hmm. And so this whole area is very sensitive to them, both environmentally for commercial and subsistence purposes, but also significant to their heritage and their culture. So there was a lot of concern, but it seemed to me that they were responding appropriately and that they just started trying to be as ready as they could.
Okay, thank you. This week, militiamen Lonnie Vernon and Schaefer Cox were sentenced in federal court Monday by Judge Robert Bryant, or they were sentenced on Monday and Tuesday. Jill, tell us about Lonnie Vernon's sentencing on Monday.
So Vernon is this gentleman from Salcha, Alaska, which is near Fairbanks in the interior. He was a foot soldier in Schaefer Cox's Alaska's Peacemakers Militia. He was sentenced in two separate cases to conspiracy to commit murder of federal officials. One, the case that Cox himself was involved in. And then Lonnie Vernon had his own axe to grind, along with his wife, against the IRS and a federal judge who had initiated and concluded proceedings against them in a tax evasion case and the potential loss of their home. So he's this angry, kind of wacky dude who at this sentencing was very defiant and outspoken, aggressive, challenging people, let profanity fly towards just about everyone in the courtroom, denied that the court had jurisdiction over him, demanded to see everybody's credentials, directed the U.S. Marshals to arrest court officers who had been involved with him in this proceeding. And so he's kind of, you know, he's a self-declared sovereign citizen, meaning he's not going to be subservient to the laws of the land, and was, you know, angry and mad. But the thing that was unusual about it is when it was all said and done, I think, Michael, you pointed this out the other day, he kind of just quietly exited the courtroom. I mean, marshals had come up around him and started kind of flanking him and standing there because
that was
he
one
was
of the, if you were there, that was one of the more interesting things. Yeah. First they were sitting, then they got up, yeah. Then they moved a little bit closer.
So that, you know, that he was increasingly agitated, and I think they were ready for some action, but he just kind of, you know, when he was done, and on he went. But he got sentenced to nearly 26 years in prison.
Did you get the sense that the judge was sort of feeling it out of what he was going to do as he went along? I mean, not the sentence, but Vernon was very profane and managed to drag in Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder and a whole lot of other people. And it looked like the judge was just saying, well, if this guy's facing a long sentence, this is who he is, I'm going to let him talk for a while.
And I think there is some of this is who he is. I mean, I think that is, we saw some of probably the true personality of Lonnie Vernon. We had heard early on that he, you know, was a little paranoid. At one point we talked to some people in the grocery store near where he lives, and he's the kind of guy that won't buy anything with a barcode because he thinks if the barcode gets scanned, they can track you. And, you know, he had his home fortified against potential federal invasion, and you know, there was some suggestion that he may have had some kind of brain trauma as a result of heavy metal poisoning years ago. And it, you know, something he's probably not your average person. He kind of came off to me like the guy that's drunk in a bar and trying to fight everybody, but he knows he can't win, but he's going to really blow off a lot of steam. And then at the very end, and Rich, I know you were there too, as the judge is handing down the sentence, he says, dismiss, dismiss, I'm not listening.
Oh, he was like a little kid.
Like a kid would do.
Yeah, you don't exist in my world. You don't exist. He did everything but put his hands over his eyes and go,
Yeah, so it was odd. But I thought the judge did a nice job managing him. I mean, he could have cut him off a lot sooner, but he gave him a lot of space to kind of air his grievances.
And it's a very sobering experience to see somebody sentenced to a long prison term.
It's sad. I mean...
Okay, Richard, you attended the Cox sentencing. Mm-hmm. What did you see, and what did you make of the psychologist's report being introduced this late in the game, a psychologist who had some findings on Cox?
Right. Well, the psychologist's report was very late in the game. I mean, the whole thing was, I missed Lonnie's sentencing, but it sounded like this was the polar opposite. Had Schaefer Cox telling this woeful tale about how I'm paranoid, I didn't realize it, I'm very sorry. But basically the psychological report said he suffered from schizophrenia, he was paranoid, he had delusions, which the judge basically said, I wrote all those things down, it's obvious, of course he does, but he's not insane. So so Schaefer ends up basically, despite again the woeful presentation. He gets the same time that Lonnie Vernon got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the judge said, you know, it not only is he not insane, but I think this diagnosis makes him even more dangerous, and he's already demonstrated he's a danger to society. And what's more, he was able to function in a way that allowed him to rope people in, to be a leader among followers, and suggested that some of Vernon's issues and the extreme to which she carried them may have been Vernon's association with Cox.
Right.
Manipulative was the word that frequently came out of the prosecutor's mouth, and probably was very accurate that Schaefer Cox was a master manipulator in his ability to get people to do what he wanted them to do, right, by telling fantastic stories, and fantastic in the sense of fantasy.
Yeah, and introducing essentially a mental health defense at that stage made me wonder, and I'm sure other people wonder, well, why didn't the defense float that at the beginning? And we weren't there, and we don't know what Nelson Traverso and other lawyers may have thought about it, but it seemed to me that for him to do that before the trial, and there would have been a whole different process, he would have had to sort of go back on all his political beliefs,
right,
which in effect he had to do here.
Right, well, he would have to say, I'm insane.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And that's a very hard defense anyway, and I don't think that would have gone very far.
Well, and there was,
he obviously was not. I mean, he was very, very smart, very manipulative.
And I think Cox brought that same attitude to his relationship with his attorney. I mean, it was very evident with his trial attorney that there was tension. And there were times when they were kind of sniping at each other.
Yeah.
And even during trial, the trial attorney had to tell Cox to, like, pipe down, like, keep your mouth closed. This is not the appropriate time. And Cox may not have let that attorney go down the road of whether or not there was a mental illness as a potential mitigator.
Yeah, there were a couple occasions in the trial when Traverso, as much as yelled at him, just answer my question.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that kind of thing.
Yes.
It seemed interesting to me, too, that there was concern from, I'd read that people were worried about how Schaefer Cox would become sort of this icon if he went to prison among militia groups across the nation. But then at the sentencing, what a switch to have Schaefer Cox just cry and be very subdued. And Lonnie Vernon, who was supposed to be a follower, suddenly was the guy that was the most outspoken. And I thought, well, this will be interesting to see how that plays out, because it almost seems that Vernon emerged as the stronger of the two when it came to sentencing.
Yet now we have Cox, who kind of took, I think, his most responsibility, as we've seen at the sentencing, saying if it was his words, he was sorry, but he didn't mean to do it, is now appealing not only the sentence, but his convictions.
Well, that's sort of in the realm of why defendants plead innocent,
mm-hmm,
I think, in my opinion. Anyway, Lori, the Culloch, once again, proved to be a disaster that wasn't. Some people might say the same thing about the big earthquake in southeast Alaska. You got called early on, I understand.
Yes. I actually was awake late waiting for the BBC to call me to talk about the Culloch. And about midnight, all of a sudden, the tsunami alert came across, and just past midnight. And so I immediately called my family in Sitka. It was the right response, because when there is a tsunami warning, there's not a whole lot of time to figure out, well, is there going to be a wave or not? Now, the fire chief in Sitka has been very judicious in when they set the alarms off, because he doesn't want to have people get what he calls cry wolf syndrome, where they won't go if they hear the siren. The big Japanese earthquake and tsunami in 2011, they didn't set the sirens off then. He didn't set it off earlier in 2012 when there was a big earthquake off the coast of British Columbia. They just monitored and decided they didn't need to. But this was so close. It was close to Craig, 30 miles off Prince of Wales Island. It was very shallow. And so they did set off the sirens. I think that the larger problem was the fact that people started going to both the schools and trying to get to Harbor Mountain Road to get to high ground before
this
the sirens.
Sitka once again.
Yes, in Sitka, sorry. Before the sirens even went off, so that they started having traffic jams quite early. And then the sirens went off, and although the fire chief was happy that people started to respond right away and did what they were supposed to, there's got to be some conversation about how to better handle the traffic flow, because I was on the phone with my son. They were stuck on this road that's right along the water, heading to Harbor Mountain Road. And I said, you know, if there is a wave, it's going to be there in 15 minutes. Maybe you better take the kids and start walking up the woods and up that mountain to get away from the water. So it was a real nerve-wracking time there for about 2 hours. It was really very scary. And the tsunami alerts that came out, the first one that I heard, the man that was reading the alert sounded breathless and a little afraid himself. And I thought, well, that's not real helpful. And the audio kept blinking in and out, so it was really difficult to hear.
And it's the middle of the night.
Well, and you know, people are already upset, so there's going to have to be some more work there to make sure that we get.
We're about out of
notices.
Time, but I wanted to ask you: Congress did not pass the Violence Against Women Act. Why? And some implications for Alaska.
Well, part of the problem is that the House objected to the version that the Senate, the Democratic-controlled Senate, had passed, a version that included protections for gay men, lesbians, bisexuals, and the Republican-controlled House wasn't buying that, so it didn't go anywhere. And then when the new Congress convenes, of course, all that legislation that was left goes away, so they have to start over again. It does leave the program in place, but it makes the funding potentially vulnerable because there wasn't a reauthorization. So the law still stands, but it doesn't mandate that things are funded. So programs are vulnerable. There's a program here that 90% of their funding comes from that.
Okay, and we're out of 100% of our time. Thank you very much for joining us on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.